Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 6 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $2.99 each. Then get flavorful large avocados for 99 cents each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This episode may contain content of a graphic nature, including descriptions of physical and sexual violence against adults, children, and animals. Listener discretion is advised.
Hi, everyone. I'm Tanya.
And I'm Talia.
And we are Crimes and Consequences, a true crime podcast. Hey, Talia.
Hi, Tanya.
How are you today?
Today's a great day. How are you?
I am doing great, and I hope everyone listening is having a fantastic day.
Probably Monday. You're probably driving.
Going to work.
Listen to some true crime.
I hope we can brighten your day slightly.
That's a really odd comment to make in a true crime podcast.
But podcasts make me happy.
And you telling a story makes me happy. So let's start this.
Let's get it done. In 1969, John Jubert was only 6 years old. However, it was a year in his life that would make a big mark on the rest of it. His parents had an unhappy marriage, and his mom, Beverly, was trying to leave his father, Jack. Beverly worked outside of the home as a bookkeeper, and Jack worked in the restaurant business. So John and his little sister, Jane, spent a lot of time with a babysitter. John absolutely hated being with the sitter, though, and would spend all day wishing his parents would come home. His hatred soon grew to something much more sinister. He had daydreams of killing his babysitter.
When he was six. That's not a good sign.
No, it's not. In his six-year-old mind, John looked at killing his babysitter like it was similar to turning a light switch on and off. One moment she would be there, and the next she would be gone. John told no one of these fantasies, and it's probably good he didn't, because they evolved into something more gruesome. He would not only picture himself killing the babysitter, he then would see in his mind kneeling beside her body after he did it, and then eating her corpse.
Oh, that's pretty morbid.
Yeah. At six. His fantasy scared him a little bit.
Me too.
Honestly, for a six-year-old. He wondered, where did these thoughts come from? But he did know one thing. He enjoyed them very much.
Sick little bastard.
I know. John didn't fit in with the kids at school, as you can probably imagine.
Okay, I kind of figured that. Sorry.
I know. And he didn't have any friends. He was teased and bullied quite a bit because he was small for his age, so that was a big thing that he got teased about. In order to make friends, he joined the Cub Scouts and thought maybe that would help him, but it didn't. There was just something always off about John.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He wanted to eat the corpse of his babysitter.
I know. Kids were just repelled from him. In 1971, John's mom, Beverly, had had enough. She divorced Jack and moved with John and his 5-year-old sister into a small apartment near Lawrence, Massachusetts. John absolutely hated this apartment. It was so cramped and tiny, and he missed his dad. He still had to spend time with that babysitter, which we know he wanted to kill and eat. And there was a new rule that the babysitter enforced. John and his sister were not allowed to go to their dad's house, even though it was right across the street from the babysitter's house. Beverly moved again with John and his sister in 1974, but this time they moved to Portland, Maine. John again had trouble fitting in at school because he probably just got weirder and weirder and didn't have any friends.
Yeah, little psychos don't have a lot of friends.
No. When he was 12, he fell in love with a girl in his class named Debbie, and he thought she was just the most beautiful girl in the whole school. But any chance that John may have had with Debbie was shattered when a classmate of John's asked him one day if he was gay. John understood gay to mean happy or jovial. So he thought for a second and he said, yeah, I'm gay. Of course, that's not what his classmate meant.
John.
So naive. And the news that John was homosexual spread like wildfire throughout the school. John knew Debbie would hear about it eventually, and he was mortified. Throughout middle and high school, the rumor that John was gay never died. The fact that he was a loner didn't help his situation much. He continued with the Boy Scouts and made it to Eagle Scout when he was 17, which is the highest level of Boy Scouts you can obtain. And side note, only 4% of Boy Scouts ever make it to that level.
Impressive.
But despite this achievement, he still had a lonely life. He never had any girlfriends, even though he did attend his senior prom. But the girl he went with was just an acquaintance, and he didn't even kiss her goodnight. During his high school years, there was a quiet rage building inside of John.
You mean his preschool years?
I know. It just never ended, right? He had a lot of anger inside of him that stemmed not only from the bullying at school, but his home life sucked too. His mother was very strict and spanked him until he was 12. And he never got to visit his dad. John kept to himself at school, and on the outside, he appeared to be a quiet, unassuming teenager who excelled in school in English and history.
But on the inside. Yeah,
but on the inside, there was a festering rage that would eventually lead John to attacking and killing 3 adolescent boys. 16-year-old John was riding the bus home from his job at the public library in October 1979. He got off on his stop, and as the bus pulled away, John noticed a boy who was walking alone on the sidewalk. John walked toward the boy behind him, so the boy didn't see him. John made his way closer and closer to the child, and when he was in earshot, he called to him, "Hey, wait a minute." The child turned around and didn't say anything, but he did stand there and allowed John to catch up to him. John asked him his name. The child replied his name was Chris Day. John then asked how old he was, and Chris told him he was 8. Suddenly, out of nowhere, John grabbed Chris by the throat and shoved him against the wall of the bank where they had been standing.
Out there in public.
Out there in public. Right. Chris struggled, but it only made the grip that John had on his throat tighter. John saw how Chris's face grew red the tighter his grip on his throat became, and the boy thrashed about wildly, with his arms and legs just flailing about. John let him go as suddenly as he had grabbed him, and Chris took off as fast as he could.
Hell yeah.
Right? It could have been a lot worse.
As I'm sure you're going to tell me.
Unfortunately. John had a paper route, and he was out delivering the morning paper one early morning, about a month after attacking Chris.
And he's in what, 10th grade?
Right, he's 16. He's got to be
10th
or 11th grade. He had been thinking about the attack on Chris and wanted to do it again. He just had to patiently wait for the chance. His chance came when he saw a child walking along the sidewalk. He called over to her and didn't realize she was a girl of about 7 to 9 years of age until he got closer because she was bundled up so much from the cold. She had stopped in her tracks, which allowed John to catch up to her. He told her to come here. And when she asked why, he said he wanted to talk to her. She asked him, "Are you going to take me home?" And she told John she had a doctor's appointment that morning and she had to get going. He told her, "Go ahead," and let her go. He was surprised, though, over how she didn't seem to be afraid of him, and neither did Chris.
Because he's a kid, still.
Right, exactly, right? You trust other kids. While John let the girl go, he wasn't discouraged because he viewed this time in his life as a learning experience. He had already learned younger children weren't afraid of him. He knew it wouldn't be long before another opportunity to attack a child would present itself. On December 11th, 1979, so this is probably a month later, 9-year-old Sarah Canty was playing outside with a football. She never noticed the boy on his bike until he sped past her when she bent down to pick up the football. When Sarah went to stand up, a shooting pain went through her back. She screamed and was crying hysterically. Her parents heard her and came outside to investigate. And when they looked, they found a 1/4-inch puncture wound on her back that penetrated her jacket, shirt, and undershirt. Police thought it had been made by a pencil or maybe a screwdriver.
Ugh.
I know. By the time Sarah's parents had gone outside, there was no sign of the boy who attacked her. Sarah gave a detailed description of the boy on the bike, but the police weren't successful in finding him. It would be years before anyone would discover that 16-year-old John had attacked Sarah and would go on to earn the nickname the Oakdale Slasher in the newspaper.
It's got to be in a radius that's relatively close.
Right.
Bullshit. Bullshit. They didn't try.
6 weeks after his attack on Sarah, on January 24th, 1980, John noticed a woman walking in the evening around 7 p.m. She was 27-year-old Vicky Goff, who was on her way to her creative writing class at the University of Southern Maine. Vicky said hi to John as he walked by and thought nothing more about him until he came up behind her and put his hand over her mouth to prevent her from screaming. Vicky never got a good look at John since he was behind her. After he grabbed her, Vicky felt a pain in her side that felt like she'd been punched. She fell to the ground as John ran away and yelled after him, "Why'd you do that?" Vicky touched her side and saw blood. She realized that John had stabbed her. She ended up getting medical help and spent a week in the hospital after suffering a punctured kidney that required surgery to mend. Vicky had only recently moved to Portland with her husband, and after the attack, she moved because she was so frightened and no longer felt safe in the area. Exactly 2 months later, on March 24th, 9-year-old Michael Witham was walking along a sidewalk in Portland. Up ahead him was a hill where John was on his bike. He yelled to Michael, telling him to come here. When Michael caught up with him, John asked him personal questions like, "Where do you live and how old are you?" John then told him, "Look down there." And when Michael turned to look, John grabbed him from behind and cut his throat with an X-Acto knife he stashed in his pocket.
Damn.
I know. John fled, and luckily, Michael survived, but he had to get 12 stitches to close the 2-inch wound that was made.
Holy shit.
I know. All of these crimes occurred within a 2-mile radius of John's home, but he was never a suspect.
See, that's what I don't get. Mm-hmm. I knew he's on a bike. The radius has to be very small.
Right.
And they can't figure out this killer biker.
I know. I guess he was 16 and they never suspected a kid did it. A few days after he attacked Michael, John was riding home on his bike after visiting an uncle. He stopped off at his Boy Scout meeting before going home. As the meeting was ending, some of the older scouts were warning the younger ones, "Look out for the Oakdale Slasher." It was only at that point, when John fully realized what he'd done, that his fantasies hurt people, and he got a little scared. He vowed to himself that he would stop, and he did, for a while. That is, until August 22nd, 1982.
So what's that time frame? How long could he control himself?
Almost 2.5 years. Back Cove was a popular trail that joggers and people riding their bikes frequented near downtown Portland. On August 22, 1982, 11-year-old Ricky Stetson decided to go for a jog on Back Cove and set out to the trail around 8 p.m. Ricky was small for his age. He looked like he could have been about 9, and he only weighed about 60 pounds. He was wearing his favorite jogging suit. It was gray, with raised letters that spelled out USA on the chest. Ricky had been jogging the trails in Back Cove many times before without any incident, and he had no reason to think this time would be any different.
Do not jog alone in a trail.
Ever. Ever.
Many people along the trail noticed Ricky. He was a little boy with red hair and freckles. He was adorable. By the way, he probably stood out though. But witnesses also noticed John on his bicycle following a short distance behind Ricky. When it got dark and Ricky hadn't returned home, his parents called the police to report him missing. Sadly, Ricky's parents didn't have to wait long before finding out what happened to him. His little body was found the next morning at 7:06 a.m. He was underneath a pedestrian footbridge and was laying on his side. His right arm was extended above his shoulders, and his left arm rested on his stomach, streaked with blood. His gray sweatshirt, the one he loved so much, was now soaked with his blood, so it was like a rust color. It was no longer gray. His pants had been pulled down, but only to the hips due to a drawstring at the waist being tightly tied. However, grass and dirt were found inside of his sweatshirt, and there also were no rips or punctures on his sweatshirt, which led police to believe that whoever had killed Ricky had either taken his sweatshirt off and stabbed him, or had Ricky remove it himself before murdering him and putting it back on his body. Ricky had suffered a stab wound to his chest, which killed him.
Maybe his shirt could have been pulled off?
Maybe.
Like from dragging or struggle?
Maybe. They didn't mention like any grass stains though, so who knows?
I'm not a crime scene specialist.
Ricky also showed signs of being strangled both manually and with some type of ligature. There were bite marks on Ricky's right calf.
A bite mark on his calf?
On his calf.
On his lower leg.
Mm-hmm. In an attempt to distort the marks, the killer had gouged them with a knife, hoping to cover his tracks.
Do they know if he was alive at the time?
He was not alive at the time, I don't think.
Well, then that would explain the bite mark on the calf.
Ricky showed no signs of being sexually molested. Police ended up arresting a suspect, Joseph Anderson, but he was released when his dental impressions failed to match the bite marks found on Ricky. Ricky's case ended up going cold because they really did not have any other suspects. And spoiler alert, John did it. When Joseph Anderson was arrested, John had already fled Maine by joining the Air Force.
So he's about 18 now then, right?
Mm-hmm. And he was attending basic training 1,500 miles away in San Antonio, Texas. That's why they couldn't track it to him. He was no longer there. During basic training, John made a friend, the first and only he would ever have, who we will call Eric. After basic training, both John and Eric were assigned to Offutt Air Force Base in Bellevue, Nebraska. At Offutt, John trained to be a radar tech, as did Eric. They also both requested to be assigned at the same barracks, and they ate all their meals together. However, things started to change between Eric and John about a month after they were assigned to Offutt. Eric had started distancing himself from John, and John confronted him about it.
He figured out John's a weirdo, right?
Something.
That's what happened. Yeah.
Eric had asked for a room transfer after the other guys in the unit had noticed how much time John and Eric spent together and started teasing Eric about it. Like saying he's gay and that kind of stuff. John was crushed to find out that Eric was moving out.
I mean, that's kind of stupid.
It is kind of stupid.
I mean, what, they can't just be friends?
Right, they can't just be good friends.
BFFs? Boys can't have BFFs.
I know, boys aren't allowed to do that. John begged him not to go and told Eric that they knew the truth. They weren't gay.
Right.
But it wasn't enough for Eric to stay. By August 1983, a year after John murdered Ricky Stetson, he fell into a deep depression. Friendless once again, John tried to distract himself during his free time by building model airplanes.
Oh, shit. Stop it.
He's not going and picking up girls or anything? No. Or hanging out with other guys?
That totally
or...
fits my impression of an Eagle Scout. No offense to any Eagle Scouts out there.
During one evening of building the models, John was preoccupied and accidentally cut himself with the X-Acto knife he was holding. Blood was pouring from the wound, and John quickly went and visited the base hospital. The wound required stitches, and before he went back to his barracks, a nurse gave him a roll of surgical tape, lots of gauze, and a box of surgical gloves to help keep his wound dry when he showered. Even after the wound healed, John kept the items the nurse gave him in his car, especially when he realized they could be useful.
In case he cuts himself again?
Nope. The following month, on Sunday, September 18th, 1983, in Bellevue, Nebraska, 13-year-old Danny Joe Eberle woke up at 5:45 a.m. He woke up so early because he had a newspaper route that he had to attend to. The route consisted of about 70 houses. His dad, Leonard, urged him to get up and get moving, so Danny got out of bed and got ready. He knew his customers were relying on him to deliver the Sunday paper in time for breakfast, and he was usually done by 8 a.m. He had been delivering the Omaha World Herald for the past 6 months, and he loved earning his own money. He earned about $20 a week, and a good portion of his paycheck went to buying his own clothes and school supplies. He also had fun with his earnings and indulged in his favorite pastime, playing the video game Pac-Man.
Love Pac-Man.
Love Pac-Man.
Caused me anxiety when I saw those ghosts, but I loved it.
I know, I gotta get there, gotta get there. As Danny Joe went outside to head out to deliver his route, his aunt and uncle were in the driveway in front of the house packing up the last of their belongings in a U-Haul truck. They had been staying with Danny and his family along with their five children because Uncle Tom had lost his job in South Dakota. However, the family was heading back to South Dakota that morning because Uncle Tom had miraculously found another job and the family was heading home. Before he was ready to start his deliveries, Danny was securing the last of his newspapers with rubber bands in the parking lot of a nearby Dairy Queen. Danny was oblivious to what was going on across the street while he bundled the papers. John was watching him in those early morning hours from the convenience store across the street.
What's John doing up?
Doing this.
Creeping.
Creeping. Being creepy is what he was doing. Danny got on his bike and pedaled away to start his route. John started up his 1979 beige Nova and drove it in the same direction as Danny. In order to not look too suspicious, he drove past Danny and pulled into a gravel parking lot in the back of a dentist's office and parked his car. As he got out of his car, he put surgical gloves on, those ones that were handy-dandy from the nurse, and headed in the direction where Danny was busily delivering the Sunday paper. He approached Danny on foot, and Danny said hello to him. He curtly replied a hello and walked past Danny, then stopped walking. Unbeknownst to Danny, John had turned around and watched Danny as he delivered to the first three houses on his route. By the time Danny went to deliver the fourth house, John had stealthily caught up to him and put his hand on Danny's shoulder. Startled, Danny could only mutter hello again, and John grabbed him and put his hand over Danny's mouth. John had a knife with him, which he held up for Danny to see. It was like a hunting knife. Danny's eyes grew wide in terror seeing the knife, and John told him not to make a sound and to come with him. Danny let go of his bike and his bag of newspapers and walked to John's car. Once they got to the car, Johnny told Danny to lay down on his stomach in the gravel and to put his hands behind his back. John opened his car door and tied Danny's hand together with a rope he had in his glove box. After tying his hands together, John turned Danny around on his back. The two made eye contact as John put surgical tape over Danny's mouth. John picked Danny up and put him in the trunk of his car. The car started, and John drove about 4.5 miles to an open field. He parked the car on the side of the road and went around to the back, opened his trunk, and lifted Danny out. He carried Danny a little ways into the field and laid him down. And I've seen pictures of this. It's literally a field, and there's fields all around. Like, there is an intersection, but there's no big stoplights or anything like that. It's just land.
With grass?
Yeah, with grass. And yeah, it's like, yeah, exactly. Tall grass, but not too tall. Okay. Not like up to your neck or anything like that. Once Danny was on the ground, John untied him. He commanded Danny to take off his shirt, and then he helped the boy remove his pants. Danny was now in his underwear, still laying on the ground, and John retied his hands and tied his feet with the rope. John took out his hunting knife, and when he did this, Danny begged for his life because the surgical tape had loosened on his mouth and he was able to speak. As he begged, John suddenly plunged the knife into Danny's back. Danny gasped and begged for John, "Please just take me to the hospital." He said, "I won't say anything if you just take me to the hospital." However, it was too late for Danny. John had come too far to turn back. He stabbed Danny 4 more times in the back before turning him over and stabbing him another 4 times in the chest. He slashed the back of Danny's neck to make sure he was dead, but he wasn't done. John then viciously bit Danny on the upper backside of his left leg and twice on his upper left shoulder.
It's like a compulsion for him, right?
Right. He tried to obscure the bite marks by gouging the flesh where he had left his teeth impressions. He also left a star-shaped carving on Danny's chest. And I never figured out what that exactly meant. And John never said anything about that. After killing Danny, John stood up to admire his handiwork. He had mixed emotions, pride and shame, and the overwhelming rush of excitement. He thoroughly enjoyed murdering Danny. He looked at his hands that were covered in Danny's blood and he wiped them along with the knife on Danny's clothes. He flung the clothes in the field and dragged Danny's body into an area where the grass was tall enough to hide it from the traffic that would soon be coming. As he was doing this, John noticed that the sun was beginning to rise. The darkness of the early morning was being replaced with daylight. He got into his car and drove to McDonald's to enjoy breakfast.
Because he's fucking hungry now.
Yes, he worked up an appetite. John returned to his barracks at the Offutt Air Foot Base after his hearty breakfast, and he spent most of that day masturbating to the memories of Danny begging for his life.
What the hell?
I know, sicko.
I'm surprised he didn't molest him.
I know. I'm surprised he didn't molest any of them. He didn't, though.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. Around 7 a.m. that same morning, the phone was ringing at Danny's house. Danny's mom answered the call from one of Danny's customers saying that he hadn't received the paper yet. Danny's mom, Judy, assured the customer that the delivery truck was probably late dropping the papers off to Danny because she knew Danny was on time when he left the house that morning. When the phone rang again, Danny's sister, Maria, answered the phone. It was Danny's boss, and Maria told him she would go get her dad. Leonard got on the phone, and Danny's boss told him that people were calling him about missing their papers, and that he had already looked for Danny along his route, and he didn't find anything.
Wow, people really want their Sunday paper.
Damn! Leonard told the boss he would meet up with him, and together they found Danny's bike leaning against a tree and his sack of Sunday papers in front of a home on Danny's route with a large rock on top of it to secure the papers from blowing away. Leonard went home and he and Judy went to the police to report Danny missing. A responding officer had them fill out some forms and told them just go home and wait while the police searched. Danny's parents told the police that maybe Danny had been a stowaway in the U-Haul that his aunt and uncle were driving back to South Dakota. But when they were eventually contacted, Danny wasn't with them. And any glimmer of hope that Leonard and Judy had really diminished with that news. 3 days after he was kidnapped, on September 21st, Danny's body was discovered in a grassy area just off the road near Offutt Air Force Base. Danny was found lying face down, only wearing his underwear, with both his hands and his feet bound with rope. He had been stabbed 11 times. The FBI got involved with Danny's murder investigation, mainly because there was a 12-year-old paperboy who was kidnapped in Des Moines, Iowa, the year prior. That boy was named Johnny Gosch.
That's a famous case.
It is a famous case.
There's an awesome documentary on him.
Right, and so you probably know that case is still open and unsolved.
I think it's called Where's Johnny?
Yes, it is called Where's Johnny, because I did look it up. Johnny's case was still open and unsolved when Danny's body was found. Johnny's kidnapping has never been solved and remains a cold case in Des Moines.
Fascinating story, guys.
Yeah. Interesting note about Johnny's case, he was the first child to be featured on milk cartons as part of a campaign to find missing children.
Yep.
That was little Johnny. FBI profiler. The wonderful Robert Ressler.
Love Robert. He went to Michigan State. Go
green.
Thank you.
Go blue. Just kidding. Oh, I know that just gets you right there every time I say it. Robert was asked to give a profile of the man who killed Danny. He determined that the killer must be of a small stature because Danny's body was close to the road. And the killer wouldn't have been very strong and wasn't able to carry Danny's body further into the field. He also determined that the murderer wasn't very experienced and may not have known the area where Danny's body was found very well, mostly because it hadn't been hidden. Later, he would amend the profile to include that the killer spent time with adolescent or teen boys, probably through some organization or club where he met them. He suspected the killer had some knowledge of homicide investigations and probably got his knowledge through detective novels or magazines, mainly due to how the killer tried to obscure the bite marks on the body. Before I continue the story, let's take a break.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 6 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $2.99 each. Then get flavorful large avocados for 99 cents each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
In August, right before he killed Danny, John met Don Shipman for the first time. Don was a Boy Scout master and was looking for an assistant with the hopes of finding someone who could take over the troop. John contacted Don in the hopes of filling the spot. Don was immediately impressed with John's clean cut, good looks, and warm personality, because John is a cute boy.
Yeah, I know. I saw pictures of him as an adult. He's a good-looking man on death row. Spoiler alert.
You don't really find many of those.
No, you don't.
You don't. Don told John he would be in touch. Don did some background checking, like he contacted John's supervisors at the base, and they all said that even though he hadn't been there long, he was progressing like he should, which cemented in Don's mind that John was the man for the job. He invited John to his home for an upcoming get-together with the scouts in the troop and their parents, which actually took place the very same day that he murdered Danny.
So later in the afternoon or evening?
Yes. During the party, instead of talking about troop business, all anyone could talk about was Danny's disappearance. John took some pleasure in wondering how these parents would react if they knew he was Danny's killer. He found it all very surreal, so much so that early the next morning, he drove out to the field where Danny's body was to make sure it had really happened and it was real. John went back to the base and again masturbated to Danny's pleas for his life.
Asshole.
An activity that John enjoyed doing when he wasn't being a total creeper, was playing video games. Not long after Danny's murder, John was playing at the same convenience store where he had spotted Danny, and he saw another boy who looked familiar to him. He asked the boy if they'd met before, and the boy introduced himself as Jeremy Culver, one of the boys in John's Boy Scout troop. Over the next couple of weeks, John and Jeremy developed a friendship, and Jeremy invited John over to meet his parents. When he came over, Jeremy showed John his room, and John immediately noticed Jeremy's Dungeon and Dragon items.
Nice.
Just kidding.
John loved D&D, and he and Jeremy would end up playing all the time. Since it was recent news, and Jeremy being close to Danny's age, Jeremy brought up Danny's abduction and murder when he was with John, and the two started talking about it. No, John didn't confess to the crime. Jeremy told John he was afraid of the killer who had murdered Danny. He didn't understand why someone would kill a kid, and he was afraid he would be next. John told him the killer was a jerk, and not to worry about the killer coming after him. Jeremy was insistent, though. He was really scared, and he was having nightmares.
If only he knew how scared he should be.
Right? John assured him, though, Jeremy had nothing to worry about. John promised him. About 3 months after Danny's murder, on December 2nd, 1983, Christopher Walden was getting ready for school. His mom was making his breakfast while he was dressing and combing his hair. He was 12 years old, and at the age where he started noticing the girls in his class, looks were important to Chris, and he was making sure his hair was just perfect. When Chris emerged from his room and went down the stairs to eat his breakfast, his mother noticed he was wearing his brand new tennis shoes.
It's gotta look good.
Right, exactly. Gotta impress the girls. It had snowed in the days previous, and his mother was not going to have Chris ruin his new shoes by trudging through the snowy sidewalks. She had him go back upstairs and change into his winter boots. Chris was irritated, but he did as he was told. As he walked up the stairs, though, he stomped as hard as he could to make sure his mom heard his displeasure in having to change his shoes. I can just picture that, too. Stomp, 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 stomp.
Damn kids.
When he finally got downstairs, he hurriedly ate his breakfast and got his coat on to leave. His mom reminded him to wear his hat, to which Chris protested and said that it was going to ruin his hair. But his mom was having none of it. Chris walked out the door to walk the 8 blocks to school, wearing his hat and winter boots as he was instructed. This would be the last time his mother ever saw him alive. John's urge to kill again was nagging at him. Since he had killed Danny, he had cruised around Bellevue a few times, scoping out possible victims, but none of them had panned out. That was until he spotted Chris walking to school. John parked his car and walked across the street to catch up to Chris. He did like he always did, said to Chris, "Hey, wait a minute." And Chris stopped and waited for John to catch up with him. John put his hand on Chris's shoulder and told Chris that he was to come with him, and if he did, he wouldn't get hurt. John put his arm around Chris and pushed him toward the car. When they got there, John had Chris get in and stay on the floor in the front seat. John went around to the driver's side, and when he got in, Chris was crying. As the tears streamed down Chris's cheeks, John briefly entertained the idea of letting Chris go. He didn't, though, because he knew Chris would probably immediately go to the police, and besides, the desperate need to kill was eating away at John so much that he knew he had to satiate it soon.
Sounds like his last spark of humanity died right there.
Mm-hmm. Right. John pulled the car into traffic, and he and Chris drove for about 10 minutes before John pulled over. He told Chris to get his books and get out of the car. The two walked along railroad tracks for a few minutes, and John led Chris into some woods that were nearby.
Was he holding a knife or anything?
Yeah, he had a knife. I'm sorry, I didn't mention that. Yes, he had a knife. After walking for a minute or two, John stopped the boy and told him to take off his clothes but to leave his underwear on. He instructed Chris to lay down in the snow, and when Chris protested because of the cold, John snapped and he commanded him to lay down. He then took a hold of Chris's throat with one hand and the other on Chris's shoulder, and he shoved Chris to the ground. With Chris on his back, John knelt on his chest while continuing to squeeze Chris's throat. He never removed his hand from where it was. Chris fought hard for his life, and John's grip tightened, cutting off Chris's air supply. In a panic, Chris used all of his strength to try and roll away from John, and he almost succeeded. But John had more than his strength available to subdue Chris. He had his hunting knife. John pulled the knife out and plunged it into Chris's back as he tried to roll away. John stabbed him several more times before he slit Chris's throat in his final act to see if Chris was alive. When Chris didn't arrive to school, he was immediately reported missing. With the community already on high alert due to Danny's murder and disappearance, police took Chris's abduction very seriously. 2 days after he was abducted, Chris's body was found by two men who were out hunting pheasants in the wooded area where John had killed him. It was only about 3 miles from where Danny had been found. Chris's body was found frozen and covered in snow. He was only wearing his underwear like Danny. But unlike Danny, Chris's hands and feet were not bound. The cut to his throat was so deep he was nearly decapitated, and there were bite marks on his body that had knife gouges to try to obscure the bites, like Danny and Ricky. Chris was not sexually assaulted. A few witnesses came forward that had seen John and Chris together and gave police a description, which was made into a police sketch that was released to the media.
People saw them together?
Yes. There was one woman who saw them. She was in her car at a stoplight and had watched as John and Chris, like he was pushing Chris toward his car. And she thought something was strange. And when she later saw the news story, she was like, oh my God, I think I saw that boy get abducted. Like she was so upset.
Wow.
Yeah. There was also another lady who was walking her dog that saw the abduction. The woman that was walking her dog, the police ended up putting her under hypnosis. And she remembered that the man drove a tan-colored car and that his license plate began with an R. A little over a month after Chris was killed, on the morning of January 11th, 1984, preschool teacher Barbara Weaver was in her classroom preparing for the upcoming school day. She'd been following the news story about Danny and Chris's murder and had seen the composite sketch that was released. Barbara was a religious woman who had been praying a lot about the boys and wished God would use her in a way that would help solve the cases.
I do that too.
Like, please just let me help.
Let me find a body.
Wait.
Let me find out what happened to JonBenet Ramsey. Please, Lord.
Please, just let me find out. As she was busily preparing, Barbara looked out her classroom window to see to the school parking lot. She saw a car that she had never seen before parked in the lot, and inside it was a young man that, to Barbara, looked an awful lot like that composite sketch she saw on the news.
Wow.
While she looked at him, she made eye contact with him, and he gave her an extremely uneasy feeling. She was so weirded out, she ran to her desk to scribble down the license plate number of the man's car.
What's he doing at a preschool?
I don't know.
I don't want to know.
I know. Stop it.
But I do.
A minute or two passed when the door to Barbara's classroom flung open. The man from the parking lot, who, you guessed it, was John, was standing in front of her with a knife.
What?
I know, this is crazy.
What the fuck?
John told her he was going to kill her, but Barbara's adrenaline was on high alert. She managed to get past John and ran out of the school to a home that was across the street. She frantically banged on the door and the homeowner answered. Barbara told him of what just happened and he allowed her to use his phone to call the police. While Barbara was at the neighboring house, John got in his car and sped away.
Wait, she was at the preschool, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Detectives tracked the license plate number Barbara had written down to John, and they found he was a 20-year-old radar technician at Offutt Air Force Base. Police thought they had their man. John matched Robert Ressler's profile to a T, He was young, small and not very strong, and he volunteered at a local scout troop. When they searched John's barracks on the base, they found several softcore porn detective magazines.
What?
I don't know. They were like true crime magazines? I don't know. John's car was also searched, and a hair that matched Danny Joe Eberle was found. They also found medical tape, a knife, and in the glove box was a piece of rope. The rope that had been used to bind Danny's hands and feet matched the rope found in John's car. And this just wasn't any piece of rope. It was a really damning piece of evidence because it was very unique. Inside the rope were over 100 different colored fibers, and they were all made from different materials, like some were cotton and some were synthetic, and it was very rare and unusual. Like the FBI's rope expert or whatever it was didn't even know where it came from. But I know where it came from.
I was going to say, do you?
I do know where it came from. It came from Don Shipman, the Boy Scout Master. He had given it to John. It was not one that was common at all. John was arrested on January 12, 1984, and was charged with the murders of Danny Joe Eberle and Christopher Walden. John pled guilty to both murders and gave police all of the details of what happened. Sarpy County Sheriff Patrick Thomas sat down with John after he had confessed to murdering Danny and Chris. Sheriff Thomas had been on the task force investigating the murders from the day Danny disappeared. During the sit-down with John, Sheriff Thomas asked him if he were to release him, let him go free. Did John think he had learned his lesson and wouldn't kill again?
He can't stop himself.
No. John thought about it, though, for a long time before telling Sheriff Thomas that no, he didn't think he had learned his lesson, and he would most definitely kill another little boy again if he were given the chance. John told him he was glad he got caught because he couldn't stop himself. Like you said, it was a compulsion.
It's like crack. Mm-hmm. I mean, killing is their crack. I've read all of these serial killer profiling books and with interviews with serial killers, and they say it's a compulsion they cannot control.
That's wild.
Not all of them, but
yeah. Wow.
It's like vaping.
My compulsion is eating cheesecake.
I know. Same. It's like vaping, only different.
I can't stop myself.
We digress.
After John had been arrested, Robert Ressler was giving a presentation at the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia, featuring the profile he had made of Danny and Chris's killer. In attendance at the presentation was a police officer from Portland, Maine. He was quite interested in Robert's presentation because the killings in Nebraska sounded very much like the murder of Ricky Stetson.
John didn't confess to Ricky's?
Not yet. And Ricky's case was still unsolved at this point. Like Danny and Chris, Ricky had those bite marks that had been gouged with a knife in an effort to obscure them, and they ended up being John's signature. The police officer went to speak to Robert after the presentation to discuss Ricky's case, and they discovered John had lived in Portland at the time of Ricky's murder. A cast of John's teeth was eventually matched to the bite marks made on Ricky.
Even though they were gouged?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was unsuccessful in all of these cases in obscuring them where they couldn't be photographed properly or anything. He was unsuccessful. John was questioned by police from Portland about Ricky's murder, and he confessed. During that confession, he also admitted to being the Oakdale slasher. He said those attacks were practice for the murders he eventually committed. John was convicted in Maine of Ricky Stetson's murder and sentenced to life in prison. In Nebraska, John was found guilty in Danny and Chris's death and was sentenced to death. He didn't wait too long for his day of reckoning and was executed on July 16, 1995 by electric chair. He was 33 years old. And Talia, you've seen that mugshot of John.
He looks like a perfectly normal, handsome American man.
Right. It's
shocking.
It is very shocking.
How normal it is.
And that was taken right before he was executed.
That's crazy. His beard's all trimmed and nice.
And his hair's neat. He's not like Popeye missing an eye or anything.
No.
It wasn't creepy at all. He's just looking like you said, like a regular guy. I read a book where I got the information for this podcast today. It was called A Need to Kill, The True Crime Account of John Jubert, Nebraska's Most Notorious Serial Child Killer by Mark Pettit. He wrote the book based on many face-to-face interviews he had with John while he was on death row.
No.
It started off as a letter saying, you know, would you be willing to talk to me? And at first John told him no, and then Mark wrote him more letters. They ended up developing a friendship.
You should do that with some serial killer, Tanya.
Yeah, no thanks.
For our podcast and our listeners.
No thanks. Mark actually had to testify in Ricky Stetson's trial. So, and it was based on some of the things that he had said, that John had said.
Wow.
So that is my story of John Jubert.
I did not know about John Jubert before
this. Me either. And it didn't happen that long ago.
Yeah, you're right.
You know?
It's so weird that he didn't molest them.
I know. I know how funny that we're saying that, but it is. You would think that was the motive, but it wasn't.
Was he a pedophile?
No. No, he wasn't. Everything I read, including like that psychological spreadsheet that you see on some of the killers that we find like on Murderpedia and stuff, he didn't molest any kids.
What's his therapist say? Do we have those records?
I wish.
Well, thank you for that fascinating true crime tale.
You're welcome. And if you are still listening, please...
What do you say if you're still listening?
If you're still with us. Don't forget to subscribe or follow on whatever podcast app you're listening to us on. If you'd like to find out more information about today's episode, you can go to our website, tntcrimes.com, or our other episodes. If you'd like to become a member and get all of the benefits membership gives you, which are extra episodes, mini episodes,
early releases,
commercial-free, and live episodes.
Sometimes they're good. Sometimes they're scary. Like last week's live episode.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes we won't even talk about that.
20-minute technical problems. Because Tanya didn't get the fucking go live button. That's a fucking classic, Tanya.
Like,
It's not working.
Why? I'm in a panic. You can go to patreon.com/TNTcrimes.
Check us out.
Yeah. And also go to social media. We are on Facebook and Instagram at Hardcore True Crime.
You know what it's time for?
What is it time for?
Some shout outs.
Let's do it. Who do we have, Talia?
You know, I'm really bad at pronouncing names.
Yes, so please bear with us. And I'm going to hold my applause until the end.
Thank you. Vinciane, Debbie, Bonnie, Amber, Jay, Jeffrey, Jenna, Clevenol, Zipporah, Gabrielle, Kelly B, Brooke, Brandy, Catherine, Jordan, Beth, Adita, Eric, Sarah, Stephanie, Chrissy, Judy, Teresa, Stephanie, Riley, Coriel, Sandy, Aaron, Monica, Tina, Erica, Trissy, Tiffany, Katie, Michelle, Elaney, Andrea, Kenneth, Velvet, Samantha D, and Lori. And last but not least, Laura.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, guys. Big round of applause for our new Patreon members.
We hope you are enjoying all of the extra episodes.
And we love our other members, too. Thank you guys for supporting us.
And until our next episode,
don't kill each other.
Bye.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.